Hey, this is Nick Gelso, co-owner and founder of CLNS Radio. Today's podcast is brought to you by Lynda.com. Lynda.com is the home of expert video tutorials. Because you're such a loyal listener of CLNS Radio, and it's 2015, you want to kick the new year off in style, claim your free trial today from CLNS by going to Lynda.com/CLNS. That's LYNDA.com/CLNS. Now on to your regularly scheduled program.
Oh yeah! Having fun with it tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, I am. My name is Matt Rury. This is Careless Whispers on CLNS Radio. We're a little later than normal because of various things that went on this evening. But Calvin Chamberlain is here, and the show must go on. Hello, Calvin.
That's me.
Hello.
I sludged to the downpour that's going on over here.
It's raining in California?
It is. It's good because we have a drought. I don't know if you've heard the news about the drought in California that's been going around.
I have not heard the news. I've just been with my head in the sand or something. I don't know. I don't know what's going on, but I'm glad it's raining for you.
Yeah, it's good news. Good news for the people. You know, we like water around here. We like to be able to drink things. Like
sure.
Showers. I like doing the laundry.
You just look up in the sky and open your mouth, and then you got water for the night right there. That's all
there you
need.
Go. I like green lawns, you know?
Do people freak out when it rains out there?
The news freaks out, which is one of the best things about living here, is that whenever it rains, they'd send local reporters to, like, a random street corner. And then they'll have, like, it'll be, like, Stormwatch 2015. And it'll just be, like, round-the-clock coverage of the rain that you can actually see by just going outside. And the other thing that sucks about it, though, is the second a drop of rain hits the road, people start driving, like, 8 miles an hour.
It's, right, that's yeah, the question. That's what more like yeah. More what I meant by them freaking out. I figured that around here drive like jerks when it's raining and they freak out a little bit. And they must be going crazy out there in California.
Yeah, everyone just moves way too slow. That's all. I hydroplaned once about, I want to say, like 200 feet on a freeway coming down a huge hill. It was like, you know, torrential downpour situations, and what it was it was like a huge hill, and then the other side was a huge upturn. And so at the bottom of this freeway, I was on the freeway, at the bottom of this huge hill, it was essentially like a giant lake. So I hit it about 70 miles an hour, and I sort of jet skied for like 200 feet until my tires got traction again. It's pretty scary.
Man, that stuff is scary. I've been in a situation where I've spun out on a main highway like that coming down a hill. And luckily there was coming down the hill, but I was far enough that I was able to put my blinkers on and get the car started again. But it's a scary situation, but that was ice. That wasn't rain. So I can only imagine what a hydroplane it feels like as well. Anyway, let's stop with the topic here at the top of the show. I'm starting out all over the place. This show is brought to you by Lynda.com, as Nick Gelso so kindly told us at the beginning of this, at the beginning of the podcast. That's Lynda.com. And if you head on over to Lynda.com/CLNS, you can pick up a free 10-day trial to their site. And they have a lot of great functional articles and videos and things like that. So I'll tell you a little bit more about them later. But also, you heard me open a beer at the beginning of this show. So I may as well tell you now that Peak Organic Brewing Company is also a very proud sponsor of CLNS Radio. Over to...
I heard Ray.
Yep.
Yeah, I heard that the organic beer from the Organic Brewing Company is so good that even if I had passed away, even if I passed away tomorrow, you would refuse to pour one of those delicious beers out for me.
That's probably true. I would not pour it out for you because it's good. It's clean, it's crisp, and it's delicious. You can check them out at facebook.com as well, /peakbrewing. They have some great ingredients, and I like their beer. Anyway.
Do they have ingredients at Papa John's?
Yeah. Papa John's is a joke. I'm not a fan of Papa John's. Probably should. Name. I mean, every other pizza place, like pizza, is better than Papa John's.
Well,
pizza
we're hot. Dicey internet connection really tonight. That's the worry I'm getting. That's cool.
It shouldn't be like that. I took control of that situation. I don't know why. Maybe it's your phone.
Perhaps it is my phone.
Well, either way. We are going to continue on here.
Do I sound clear?
Yeah, you sound fine.
Well, it's probably you. All right, well.
Maybe it is. I don't know. That would be there. It's just some delay.
Right.
I'm not sure. Where's your text of topics ready to go? I'm such a fool tonight. Okay, Celtics, of course. Celtics. We start with Celtics around here. Also, I forgot the. I just this. See, this is me spacing out more than anything. Maybe that's what you were hearing. 347-215-7771 is the phone number that you can give us a call at, and hit me up on Twitter as well at Team Green Truth.
We're live.
There. That's it. What? We are live.
We're live.
Yes, we are. We are live as can be. I should send the link out on Twitter. So why don't you sort of take over for a second and
okay, well, this is what I'm wondering from Celtic fans. I wish we still had callers. I lamented this on the post-game show as well. People, what happened to you guys? Just call in. You know, it's not hard. Just dial the same number. We didn't change our number. We didn't move. We're in the same place. We're at the same time. Just find us.
Yeah. Are they all? Sam and San Diego? Come on.
Yeah, where did they go? What happened to Mike and Pittsburgh? What happened to, what happened to Mad Dog? What happened to Mike Munger?
Spoiler alert, Mad Dog's actually hasn't pressed one yet, so maybe he's not ready to talk to us. Maybe he's waiting for us to say the magic word.
All right, well, here's the deal. We'll just start off with the Celtics topic since you introduced it, and then Mad Dog wants to talk college basketball. I've got some topics to bring up with that. But my question to you, Murray, is the Celtics, after looking kind of dicey, they seem to have righted the ship, or more importantly, Miami has blown some easy games, and now they're sitting in that catbird seat, right there with Brooklyn. They're a game up in for that 8 seed, but now they're only a game back for that 7 seed. Do you think that the best thing to do, Rory, is for the team to be as good as possible and sort of take credit for a slightly better year by ending with that 7 seed, but only to face the Cleveland Cavaliers in the first round, or would you rather them just stay in that tidy little 8 seed and take on the in some worlds, less daunting Hawks team? Or do you not believe that? My voice just cracked. Or do you not believe that?
Your voice did crack. So I'm this. I use this this topic show the other night. We was talking about this, and I stole something from was it Zach Lowe? I don't think it was Zach Lowe. No. I can't. Why can't I remember who I'm stealing this crap from? Because I want to credit the guy, because I saw it on. I'm gonna Google this in a second and figure out what his name is. Show to his name. But basically, his idea was that the Celtics would be better off going for that seven seed and facing Cleveland because they're going to lose the first round series regardless, and this would put them on more of a national stage than playing against the Hawks, and that's something that Brad Stevens would be able to shine in, and it would subsequently make players want to go to Boston as free agents, et cetera, et cetera. Let me find this article while I hear what you think.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, I've been on the big picture.
Of course, Rich Levine.
Who is
Sorry,
it?
Sorry, I found it already. It's Rich Levine, CSNNE.com. He's
okay, yeah,
out there
recently,
a few weeks.
I've been on the tip that winning is always better than losing. And, you know, next week before the playoffs start, one thing that I want us to do is I want to go through all the playoff teams and talk about what they'll need to make their season a success. Because I don't believe it has to be a championship. Do you think that if the Celtics make the playoffs, isn't that, you know, by definition of what their expectations were, like, shouldn't that already be a good year, Rory? Or are you just going to be unhappy?
Absolutely. No. I want them in the playoffs. Like I'm saying, I don't really think that it matters which seed they get. I think that they should do whatever comes to them. And if they're playing hard and they can get the seven seed, then by all means, they should go for it and get swept by Cleveland in the first round if that's going to be what it is. But you know what? I'm going to go out on a limb right now and say that they will not get swept by Cleveland in the first round. They will not get swept by anyone in the first round. I think Brad Stevens and this young team is good enough to take a game from anyone in the Eastern Conference in a seven-game series. So I will go on record right now as saying the Celtics will win at least one playoff game this year if they make it in.
Well, I think they might get swept by Cleveland. I don't think they'd get swept by Atlanta. But my bigger point is that it doesn't matter because it's a good year for the Celtics either way. Like, making the playoffs with the roster that they have and the talent they have, it's an impressive year. It's something to build on. It's something good. I don't expect them to win the series against either team. And do I think that, like, a five-game series as opposed to a sweep really makes that much of a difference? I mean, it's a nice little way to put on your resume, but
it's nice.
But I don't
it's
think,
nice for the players too to have that confidence, and that experience.
Definitely, and to have one more playoff game, obviously. But you know, it's nice for the fans. But I don't think the end result of losing a first round series as the 7 or the 8 seed really makes that much of a difference. And so I'd like for them to be the better team. Like the point I was making earlier was I'm tired of this notion that all these people have, where it's championship or nothing. And the problem with it is that it's ruining the very spirit of sports, because teams that, like, think that, okay, we can be bad in order to, like, try to win a title later on, it's like everything other than winning a title is meaningless. You know what I mean? So if that's how we value things, then there's no reason for anyone to compete unless they
right,
can win
no,
a title.
Right, no. I don't think not winning a title is meaningless. Anything but winning a title is meaningless, I should say. I don't think that. I think there is value in the experience of getting into the playoffs and the different type of atmosphere and intensity that the game brings in that setting. And I think that it's good for these young players to show Danny Ainge whether they can hang in that situation and whether he should be looking to keep them going forward. Now, I just lost my train of thought. I had something good, too. What is wrong with me? You know what, Calvin? I can't even remember what I was just going to say. That's what happens when you start a late show, right? Oh my gosh. I'm just all over the place. Maybe I need some Pizza Hut or Papa John's, and, whatever. Either way. Just go with it for a second.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, as a side note, as a Celtics fan, I don't care about the Hawks. In fact, I probably have warm feelings about the Hawks because, number one, the Celtics have owned the Hawks in recent years. I know it's not the same team now, but you probably have no hard feelings toward the Hawks. Like, Al Horford and, Paul Millsap are, like, the most innocuous NBA players. Like, there's no way you just have terrible feelings towards those guys. I know Mother used to hate Zaza Pachulia, but come on. That's,
oh, I still hate Pachulia. He's not on the team anymore, but I still hate him.
I always thought even that much was, like, a stretch to hate a guy. But the point is, it's like, the Hawks are so... They're so bland that, like, I'm sure you guys truly don't hate them the way that you probably do hate the Cavaliers. I mean, I don't like the Cavaliers. To me, it's more fun to play the team. And if you do bruise them up a little bit, if you can stretch that series out, even if you don't win, then you can feel good in the idea that, like, hey, you know, maybe we took a little something out of them for the next round. Whereas
Yeah, right, exactly. So, but back to your point about your bigger point, I remember what I was going to say about winning a championship or bust, that type of thing. Jeff Van Gundy the other day on one of the TNT broadcasts said that something came up about the Celtics or about coaching in the NBA or something. And he went on to say that he thought Brad Stevens had the biggest overachievement as far as looking at a roster and their position, the team's positioning right now. He thinks that the Celtics are overachieving more than any team in the NBA right now. First of all, would you agree with that? I think it's a very compelling argument that can be made. But second of all, isn't that the definition of a good season if you overachieve more than anybody else?
No, it's funny. It's funny because that sort of leads into a topic that I want to get into with Mad Dog, which we'll get into in a second. Which is, what is it exactly that makes a good coach or makes one coach better than another? Like, Do you think it's just results? Because I don't. I don't have that belief. Because
we've had this discussion before. We discussed this before, and you sort of said, I mean, I brought up the fact that I think coaching is more valuable now, and that people are finally starting to realize how valuable coaches are in the NBA, especially a good coach. But we've said before that coaching is starting to be more important now, and you sort of have come on this ride, if you want to call it that, and you've sort of turned your opinion to more what I'm have been trying to say for a long time, and just that coaches are now. I mean, is it winning? It's a chicken or egg? Do they win because they're good coaches, or are they good coaches because they win? And that was your point a few weeks ago. But I think that if you look back at people like Phil Jackson, he's a good coach because he knew how to put the players in that. He knew how to manage big personalities, and that's what was needed from him. Maybe somebody's a better basketball-minded coach than Phil Jackson is if you just threw them a random bunch of players and said, go win a game with these guys. But if you give Phil Jackson a specific type of player, he's the best coach there is. Would you not agree with that?
For me, I guess ultimately my tendency is to come down on the notion that, like, how good a coach you are depends on like how far you outperform the expectations of your talent. But the problem with that, and I realize that has a flaw, and the flaw in that is that if you have the most talent, or if you have more talent, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not as good of a coach. You know what I mean? Like, some guys are good at maximizing talent and winning when they have the most talent. Does that make you a better coach than a guy who can get more out of less? I don't know. Like, Steve Kerr is, I don't think he's the best coach in the NBA, even though he's taken the war. I think he's a better coach than Mark Jackson. But, like, how good is he actually? I mean, you could say that this team is maximizing their talent, but they also have a lot of talent. But I don't think that just because I guess to me, who's a better coach is a difficult argument because so much of it depends on players. And but I can certainly say he's a good coach. I have no idea if Steve Kerr is a better coach than Brad Stevens. You know what I mean? I can't say. All right. Now Brad Stevens right now is outperforming his talent to a greater level than Steve Kerr, but you know he also has more room to move than Steve Kerr does.
Of course, you know, of course, and that's another way to look at it. Like if the worst team in the league makes the playoffs and they overachieve more than anybody else, obviously they didn't have a better season than the team who wins the championship. I'm not trying to say that, but to look at it and say that it's not a good season because all they did was make the playoffs when nobody thought they would,
right.
I don't agree with that either. So let's get Mad Dog in on this, and we'll see how long it takes him to start his celebration and or if he can stay on topic for a second. Mad Dog up in Maine. Welcome, sir, to the show tonight. Careless Whispers. What's up, buddy?
What's going on?
He needs a song.
What's going on, guys?
Oh, you need the celebration song? Fine. Yeah. We'll give him the celebration song. Mad Dog, congratulations on the Duke Blue Devils.
Poison.
All right, that's the party time. I know it's not your favorite, Mad Dog, but that's our party song. Congratulations on the big Blue Devil win last night. It pains me to say.
Well, thank you, guys. And it's just, as you can probably tell in my voice, I'm tired. I was up until 5 in the morning and then got up two hours later. It's been a very, very exhilarating day for me. Just celebrating it and just proving once again. And this fits right into my argument, and I'm not going to mention any specific names, but there are people on this network that were debating who the best college coach was when Brad Stevens was in college. It's not a doubt after last night. I'm just going to throw that out there. After the 5th national championship and 9.
Well, let me just get this off my chest for a second. Do you think that call that they totally blew when the ball tipped off of Winston, is that his name?
Winslow.
God damn it. I'm losing my mind tonight. Thank you. When it tipped off his finger and everybody saw it on TV anyway, Jim Nance was saying the ball's got to go the other way. I was commenting to people that I was watching with that the refs were looking at a really small monitor, so it probably was not going to get overturned. Do you think that play had any real impact? I mean, it seemed like it was a pretty key point in the game, and the refs really blew that one.
Well, there were and I'm just going to throw this out there. The entire Final Four, the Kentucky and Wisconsin game was just their Trey Lyles Kentucky punches somebody in the face and they review it and they don't overturn it. These were the same officials, but yes, it was off of Justice Winslow. It was, and they really blew that. Everybody's getting on them about the out of bounds call too. The other one, but again.
Oh yeah, I even missed that one.
We saw that. Actually, it's quite funny because Wisconsin 3 weeks ago in the Big Ten championship had a very similar play happen. And again, I'm just going
right.
to Titus Jones made those shots down the stretch which were incredibly difficult. Those threes and.
All right, Matt. Let's bring it back to this coaching thing. Calvin, go ahead.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's funny because I do want to sort of talk about what Rui just brought up to you guys, but it seems like what's been going on right now, or what's been going around now, is the notion that Krzyzewski's 5 titles are now comparable to Wooden's 10 titles, and I know that you've been on board with that notion, supporting the idea that Krzyzewski should be recognized as the greatest coach of all time. And I've been hearing multiple arguments today in support of that idea. Do you want to sort of, re-support that point?
Well, the thing that I'll say is that the parity in college basketball is in the tournament size is much bigger than it was back in the 1970s. And that's not to take anything away from John Wooden, but Mike Krzyzewski he didn't win eight straight, and no one in men's college basketball is, but he has been the most consistent coach of all time, has coached his team to 12 Final Fours, not 9 championship game appearances, and now 5 titles. And you look at the entire body of work just on the fact that the level of competition has been higher, and the fact that the tournament now is much bigger than it was back then.
Isn't this kind of like the Bill Russell versus Michael Jordan argument here? Bill Russell, 11 titles. Michael Jordan, 6 titles. But Michael did it in a different era, and Jordan was more of the centerpiece in a team that really had to compete against a lot more competition than Bill Russell. Bill Russell was a dominant force, and he obviously was the centerpiece of that team. But he just was bigger than pretty much everybody in the entire league, whereas Jordan comes out in a different era and shows that he is arguably the best player of all time. And, I mean, I know players and coaches in totally different games and as far as pro versus college game, but am I out of line to make that comparison here?
Yeah, there's somewhat of a similar argument, although, like you said, with players it's different because you can actually talk about what Russell was good at and what he was bad at, but what you're talking about really is the main point that I wanted to get to earlier and illustrate with this is that there's a difference between best coach of all time and most accomplished coach of all time. You know what I mean? Like all the arguments that Mad Dog and that people use in favor of Krzyzewski, being a better coach than Wooden, all of them have to do with saying how his circumstances were different. There's more parity now. He spread it out over a longer time. It's more difficult to do. He had to win more tournament games. He didn't have the recruiting advantages. But the problem with those arguments to me is that you can take those same arguments and say, well, then how do I know then that Krzyzewski was a better coach than, say, Brad Stevens? Because Brad Stevens had to coach at a small school, brought the school to the NCAA title game twice, was in a way worse situation than Krzyzewski, and he did something different. How do I know that Krzyzewski is a better coach than Tom Izzo, somebody who's brought way less talent? Now, granted, he has a good record against Tom
Izzo.
That's
the comparison right there.
But he has less talented teams every year. Somehow he gets Michigan State to the Final Four. What Michigan State's best, who have they had since Magic Johnson? Like, how many great NBA players have they had compared to even Coach K?
Yeah. Unfortunately, the record is not very good against Coach K, so let's just say that before Mad Dog uses it.
No, but the bigger point I'm making is that, like, I don't think you can say who the best coach is in a vacuum. I think the more important thing is who's the most accomplished coach. You know what I mean? That's really, it's like Michael Jordan is clearly a better player than Bill Russell, but Bill Russell's more accomplished. And that's
right.
Something he should, you know what I mean? Like, who can,
there you go,
Calvin,
CLA there, Mad Dog. Go ahead.
Well, the whole Izzo argument is just Tom Izzo, and I do have respect for Tom Izzo, but he is a total of 1-21 against Roy Williams, Calipari, and Mike Krzyzewski. You can't be considered elite if you're 1-21 again. And we're not talking about Michigan State as some mid-major here. They play in a major conference in the Big Ten. They have had NBA NBA players. You look at who they have in the league now for the starters on the two top teams in the West. So it's Hold just.
But well, Draymond Green was not a star in college, though. In fact, he was a second round pick. They don't have a star now. Like now, you can say that again comes down to recruiting as part of coaching. And like, do you discredit him for not getting the guys who Coach K gets? But it's also like he has institutional advantages. So what do you? You know what I mean? Like, we're not even in the NBA. At least we can just talk about coaching because it's separate from GMing. Whereas in college, that's all tied together in a way that, like, it makes it, to me, almost impossible to tell amongst the, you know, few guys who are all-time great who is a better peer coach. But I can say that, again, that Coach K is the most accomplished coach since Wooden, right? I mean, shouldn't that be enough?
Here's my thing, and I'm not going to get on a whole history thing here about the Duke program. I can go on for weeks, but the Duke program before Mike Krzyzewski was not that great. It wasn't actually the Duke program before Mike Krzyzewski. UNC did not consider Duke their rivals. It was NC State. Sure, they had some success with Art Heyman and Vic Bubas, but they weren't the program that they were now. Now the thing with Mike Krzyzewski is that he did not start off recruiting these kids. He had to build the program up and that's one of the biggest credits that you have to give to him. He did not start off successful as a coach. He was almost fired after a second year. He stuck with it, and he made Duke a very desirable place to go. And that a lot has to do with the Hurley and Dawkins and Grant Hill in those days. But. Tom Izzo can recruit. Tom Izzo has had a share of McDonald's All-American. Tom Izzo has had his share of great players at Michigan State. And the name that you're forgetting, Kelvin, is Zach Randolph. Is the name that you're forgetting?
It's funny because I just Googled the list of Michigan State players in the NBA right now. Would you like to hear it? Murray, would you like to hear it?
Absolutely.
I got it myself, but go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so they have Zach Randolph. By the way, he's in his 14th season, so Tom Izzo had him 14 years ago, right?
Okay.
Okay, Alan Anderson, the great Alan Anderson, Shannon Brown, Draymond, again, who wasn't very good, he wasn't bad, but he wasn't great at Michigan State, Gary Harris and Adrian Payne. That's the list.
Yeah, the Duke list is much better, much, much, much better. Are you kidding me? Especially the recent list. It's not even close.
Yeah, and I understand that, but again, this is the thing about college basketball. A lot has to do with recruiting. In college basketball, and it does this day and age,
how much of that recruiting is now? I mean, you could say that Krzyzewski built the program up to be this number one type of organization in college basketball, but how much of that is now the program and not as much Krzyzewski for people starting to go to Duke? Are they going because of him still, or is it really because he's programming? And yes, you can credit him for that, but I don't really think that plays into how good of a coach he is.
Well, you look at the three kids that just went there. Jabari Parker was a big reason why he went there was because of Mike Krzyzewski. The Titus Jones and Gia Okafor have talked openly about it. So hasn't Justice Winslow. Many kids admire Mike Krzyzewski. And I will say this about Mike Krzyzewski. I do think that that all of his accolades in USA basketball, those kids aren't stupid when they hear good things heard from LeBron James and Kevin Durant. But this guy is an icon. And to just say, well, he recruits these guys because it's Duke. Before he got there, Duke was not an attractive place to go, and now it's an extremely attractive place to go. And it's because of Mike Krzyzewski and because of the success that Mike Krzyzewski has instilled at Duke. And
Matt, you're right. And nobody's saying that he's a terrible coach. It's just a matter of, if you want to compare who's better than who, like, how do you do that? If you're not going straight up a conference, let me take Coach K out of this, because I have an interesting question and you can answer this too, Rory, because I'm curious. Who's a better coach, John Calipari or Tom Izzo? Because if you look at Calipari's the way that he's the success that he's had in college basketball the last couple of years is better than Tom Izzo's success. Does that make him a better coach, or
no.
Do you think that, obviously he's recruited way better. Does his recruiting make him a better coach? Who's the better coach?
I've had debates about this with people, and really, I am not a fan of Calipari. I'm not.
He didn't coach those guys up very well in the game they lost, did he?
Yeah, I think that he's extremely slippery in his methods, and we've seen several different things, incidents with that with Derrick Rose at Memphis and with Marcus Camby at UF.
Yeah.
We've seen that.
You know what, Mad Dog? I feel like more often than not, Calipari gets these great players and just lets them go out and play, which for the players is probably great. They probably love it. They probably love going out there and just playing playground ball, maybe running a couple sets here and there. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I haven't seen a whole lot of Kentucky in the past few years. But from what I can tell, he's not really a lot of active coaching on the sidelines. And
I would give it to
Izzo hands down every day, all day.
Yeah,
you know who you're describing out there, right? You're describing Phil Jackson.
Well. Yeah, but Phil was able to rein them in at times, and I mean he was pulling strings to get these guys to pay attention at times, and he was the Zen master and all that, and guys bought into it. And yeah, Jordan was a big part of that, and Kobe's a big part of that, controlling things on the floor. I have to say that as well as sort of a disclaimer. But
sorry, go ahead.
No, Calipari, I was just going
to
say,
if play together, like Carl Towns averaged 8 points.
I understand. He gets the guys to buy in. That's great. But where was he when they were melting the other night? Where was he when these young kids fell apart and he didn't to even attempt to get them to calm down and get their heads back in the game? That was a total meltdown from Kentucky the other night.
Where was Phil Jackson when the Lakers were getting swept by the Mavs and they had no strategic answers?
All right, Calvin. Mad Dog, we appreciate the call, man, as always. We've got to move on because it's getting a little late in the show here. You got anything else you want to throw out there?
All right, well, I just wanted to sort of know really quickly and what Calvin's other thoughts on college basketball were. I just wanted to know that really quickly, and because he said that he did.
I definitely wanted to talk about the Bo Ryan situation and his complaints after the game about the calls. One, I think I'm okay with a coach complaining about calls because you know why? Because coaches should be biased. But that doesn't mean like people have to take them seriously. Like I think about every time that like he's playing on teams and stuff when I lost, I always felt like we were jammed. I feel like from the inside, it doesn't bother me. Like some people are calling him a poor sport, The thing, you know what else was bothering me? It's like the fact that they didn't get those calls. Because if you're trying to rely on a fingertip call from Justice Winslow to win a game, you know what I mean? Like they lost the game for a number of reasons. One is, most importantly, is that they couldn't contain Grayson Allen in the second half. He went off on them. And I thought Duke was better anyway, to be honest with you. But even more importantly than that is, Bo Ryan really made me mad at the end of that game. Wisconsin was down 3. They had their little mini comeback. I don't understand why nobody's talking about this nationally. 42 seconds left in the game. Okay, 35-second shot clock. So they could have just played. They were down 3 points. They could have just played defense on Kentucky, on Duke. You know, denied them defensively, and they still would have had 7 seconds to score. They had a timeout. They could have called that timeout, ran their play in 7 seconds. But instead, with 42 seconds left, they foul,
Wait a minute. Did Bo Ryan call for that foul? Because it looked to me like the player was just a little too aggressive, and he fell into the Duke player. Was that did you see Bo Ryan foul there?
I didn't see him call the foul, but he fouled him immediately after crossing half court, and it was a grab. I have to imagine that was intentional because it looked super intentional. Nobody said anything about it. The guy goes to the line immediately, and I'm like, you could have played defense there. There's no situation where it makes sense.
Yeah, I just saw that differently. I thought it was a bad foul.
Think about it. It was like the moment that they crossed half court that he fouled him. It doesn't make any sense that they would.
I don't know, Calvin. It just looked like he was trying to close out real high, and that he ran too far and he ran right into him. Unless we're thinking about a different play here, Mad Dog. Are you following this?
Yeah. Well, yes. And I was sitting here thinking the same thing on Wisconsin's side. It was. I believe it was a 14-second differential, and you are fouling a 91% free throw shooter during the double bonus. I did not understand.
Yeah, that's why I thought it was just an over aggressive move by the player. I didn't think it was an intentional foul, and I don't know.
It's what she looking for. If she Okafor caught that ball, then I would have been all for doing that. But
right.
but it was Titus Jones, the 91% free throw shooter. But Calvin, about the calls down the stretch, and I've heard ranting up here on the radio all day about how Duke was given this national championship. It's just ridiculous. Titus Jones made those threes down the stretch, and that's why they won the game. And Wisconsin couldn't make a shot down the straight. It's really that simple. And sure did they miss that call, but I didn't hear the absolute outrage after the Kentucky and Wisconsin game. It certainly was nothing like Game 7 of 2010. But anyway. Champions right, again. The one for the thumb is here, and I'm still celebrating, guys. But guys,
all right,
great
buddy.
Show, man.
There he goes.
Peace out, guys.
Later. There goes Mad Dog Calvin. Here's his little Gatorade bath. There we go. Congratulations, Mad Dog. Anyway, you want to hit your last little college topic here before we move on?
That's exactly what I was going to say. Before you move on to Liz or whatever we have next, I just have a question for you about this last. So I'm sure you saw it because it was national news. The press conference in which after Kentucky had lost to Wisconsin, where Andrew Harrison was at a press conference and somebody asked him about Frank Kaminsky. And he said, "F that N-bomb." Did you notice that? Did you ever see that?
I did hear. Happened to see that, and I mean, I thought it was kind of ridiculous that Kaminsky had to address it at some point. Somebody asked him about it. I mean, I thought he handled it fine. He said, "It's nothing. It's no big deal," or whatever it may be. But I mean, the fact, I mean, sure, Harrison should have to answer questions about why he would say something like that, but for Frank Kaminsky to have to get dragged into it, I thought it was a little overkill, but whatever. It is what it is.
Well, here's my question to you. Okay, so I didn't see that press conference originally. I was out. That game was on a Saturday evening. I was out, and I think it was either, you know, when I came home or the next morning I was watching SportsCenter, and, you know, the ticker on the bottom said, you know, Andrew Harrison directs racial slur at Frank Kaminsky.
Right.
So I'm sitting there thinking, like, okay, Frank Kaminsky is the Polish name. Do you call him, you know, a Polak? Or, like, what could he have possibly, like, what kind of racial slur? A hunky? Like, what kind of racial slur could he have possibly directed at Kaminsky? So then later when I hear the audio and he's saying, man, like, at that end, like, my question to you is, one, should he, like, maybe he should have to apologize for, like, his tone and his dismissiveness. But part of me, like, respects ESPN's consistency in this, because certainly if Kaminsky had said, man, at that end,
about
Andrew Harrison, I mean, forget the fact that the world would explode, but just, like,
yeah,
what ESPN would show on their ticker would pretty much be the exact same thing. So I respect the consistency as far as that goes, but I don't know. Was he trying to make it racial with Frank Kaminsky like that?
No, I would think probably not. The question wasn't even posed to him. He just said it under his breath, and he's too dumb to realize that there's a microphone in front of him, and then maybe that microphone is on. So it doesn't matter what the racial slur was or who said it. If somebody's saying something under their breath and they don't realize that it's going to get the microphone sitting in front of them, they should be ridiculed for whatever they have to say. If it's that is racially insensitive towards someone of their own race or somebody else's race, it doesn't matter. You're dumb. You shouldn't have said it.
So let's just say he said, forget that in, right? Like, would
sure. Would it's probably it, still the same thing.
My question to you: so he would still think that he would still be required to apologize because if, I don't know. My thing is, like, it's not racial in that situation. You know what I mean? Like, there are people who, like, use that word as a part of conversation, and, you know, black people obviously. Like, does that automatically make it racial? You think yes? You think, like,
no? I'm not saying it's, like, automatically racial, but it's something that I don't know.
Okay. Should Kaminsky be offended? I guess is the question. Racially?
No, certainly not. No, I wouldn't be offended. I would just be like, all right, whatever you have to say, whatever you say, I just beat your ass. Sorry.
So then, how is it cool for the media? It's so weird. It's a weird situation to me. Like, how is it cool if it's not actually racial, and it's not actually offensive? And then how is it cool?
It's not a matter of whether it's offensive or not. It's the word, Calvin. That's the big debate. Should the word be able to be used by people, by anyone, or should it only be able to be used by black people, or should it be used by nobody? Okay. That's the debate. So, the debate that's going on in America. It's just like, to me, it's just a word. I'm not offended when I hear it, so I don't know. That's my thought about it.
Let me throw this variable then at you. What if he asked about Kaminsky, and he's like, F that guy, right? And then he was asked another question.
Sure.
about whether or not he was considering going back to Kentucky, right? And he said, me and my ends have to talk it over, right? Do you think that the ESPN report would be the same way? Like,
well, no, because it's not directed at anybody. It's not their report was saying that it was directed at Kaminsky, which it was. And even if it was not Kaminsky, if it was somebody else, then of a different race, who, any, pick one. If it was directed at that person, It would probably be picked up as something racial and something that's not, or that ESPN would want to put a headline out about. If he was just saying it about himself or about his friends that, I mean, weren't present or weren't involved on a big national scale in a game that he was just playing in, then I think it would probably be looked at differently.
But I guess that's weird to me because he was using it the same way as a stand-in for guy. You know what I mean? The insulting part is the first part, the F word. Like the last part is like that's how he's referring to dudes. That's why I use the example.
That might not be the insulting part, but that's the sensation part, right? That's the buzzword part. That's what people are going to start talking about, and that's where the debate begins, and that's where ESPN gets their hits. Right?
They got me to hit on it. I had to find out what he said. But then when he said that, it just left me confused. I'm still kind of confused about it, to be honest with you. Maybe Liz can help clear it up.
And I don't want to... I thought I would just sing it this time. Yeah? And I don't want the world to see me. Yeah! Sing it, Liz. Come on, Liz, sing it.
No way.
Come on, you know it. I know you know it.
Cause I don't want the world to see me.
There you go. Liz Ferola, everybody, is brought to you by... I don't know, Liz, what do you want to be brought to you by tonight?
Oh, I hope I can be brought to you by Lynda.com.
Well, it's not going to be Lynda.com tonight. It's going to be the Reached app, huh? This is a new one. That's reachtapp.com. So go over there. reachtapp.com/CLNS. You know what that is?
On Facebook. Sure. But you know what? I was going to say I sure do, but why don't you tell me about it?
Well, the Reached app is for anyone that likes sports. Huh? Huh?
I like sports.
It's a brand new way to talk about your favorite sports teams with all your friends, actually. It's not a podcast or anything like that, but go and download the app and get hashtag on board with us today. Boom. reachtapp.com/CLNS. Liz, you scrambled to get here?
You sounded a little bit like Jim Rome towards the end of that read. That was nice.
Clones.
Like Jim Rome.
All right, clones. Here we go, Liz. Right. You're here.
Okay, sorry.
You scrambled. So, you have topics for us.
Before,
what's going on?
Yes, I have topics. I have topics. But before I give you my topics, I want to say that I'm still pissed that Duke won last night. So take that, Mad Dog. I'm like so annoyed.
But I'll give you his number. You can text.
No, I'm all set. I'm so annoyed
what's
at
worse?
That call last night. Huh?
What's worse? Duke winning a title or David Duke winning an election? It's a tough call, right?
I don't know who David Duke is.
You know who David Duke is? Well,
isn't he the cult guy?
If by cult you mean KKK, then yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. That's a cult. That's the biggest cult I've ever heard of.
That is obviously worse. Okay.
That's a huge cult. That's the biggest cult on record, right? I would call them a cult.
Yeah, it's by cult. That is absolutely some type of crazy cult. Anyways. So, my two topics are, these are two stories that I thought were really funny. You may have seen them. So, the hometown of Lucy, of I Love Lucy, Lucille Ball is her name, they have a statue dedicated to her. It's a statue of her in, like, the square that was put up 6 years ago. And there's been this petition to take it down because it's, like, a seriously scary rendition of her. It like, doesn't look anything like her. It's really bad. But it's been gaining a lot of momentum. And then they had, just recently, the artist of the statue came forward and apologized and said that it was by far his most unsettling sculpture. And he's going to, like, redo it. But if you get a chance to find a picture of her, it's pretty
terrible.
I don't
understand what's wrong with it.
Well, if you look at a picture of it, I'm going to send you
well, describe it.
But,
describe it to the listeners, Liz.
Well,
this is radio.
basically, it's thanks for clarifying.
You're welcome.
her eyes are like wide open, and she has this weird smile on her face, and she looks kind of like haunted. I don't know. She looks nothing like Lucille Ball.
It doesn't even look like a. Liz just sent me the picture, Calvin. It looks like a man. Even look like
it
a woman.
It doesn't. I don't even think it looks like a man. It looks terrible. Like I can't believe that somebody designed it, and then put it up, like had it made in bronze. But anyways, he apologized, and he feels so terrible about it that he wants to redo it like on his own, with his own money.
I mean, it definitely doesn't look like her, but I wouldn't call it frightening.
Well, he calls it unsettling, which I think it is unsettling.
Calvin, the first line of this Hollywood Reporter link that Liz, the sculptor responsible for frightening Lucille Ball statue that's been terrorizing local residents is now offering to fix it for free. Terrorize residents?
Look at it. Please. It's like the eyes are like...
How is the statue terrorize people?
I mean...
Stealing headlines. That's what that is.
Also, like, if you look at the bottom of the picture, is she holding, like, a flask or something? What is
that? No. That's Vitamina Benjamin. Don't act like you don't know.
Oh, my God. I love that you just quoted I Love Lucy. That's great. Okay.
Who doesn't know Vitamina Benjamin? Everybody knows
I can't believe that you're like, oh, yeah, that's Lucy because she's holding that ridiculous thing in her hand.
No. I didn't say it looked
terrible.
Like Lucy. First of all, it's weird that it's, like, is it, like, super old Lucy? I see all the veins and stuff in her neck. And, like,
yeah,
the weird...
Thing.
She's got, like, a weird... She's got, like, a weird James Dean pompadour thing going on.
If you scroll down, they have the clip for Vitamina Benjamin. And it's supposed to be that picture of her. It looks zero... Like, nothing like her. Like, you got, like, the two, like, necklaces that she wears. That's about it. Anyways. So I thought that was hilarious because... It's been up for like 6 years and people are so upset about it. They have like a Facebook group called We Love Lucy, Get Rid of the Statue.
I just don't care. I get that it's a bad statue. I don't disagree. What I don't get is like the idea that it's been terrorizing the neighborhood. Isn't it just kind of sitting there? And
I don't understand. How can a statue terrorize people? Come on.
I don't. Yeah. I mean, like
Hollywood
like,
Reporter.
Think about this, like, small town, their claim to fame is, like, Lucille Ball, and, like, if you really idolize someone, right, and you're like, oh, Lucille Ball, like, we really want to remember her fondly, and this is the statue you get, like, come on, seriously? And I love, I just realized at the bottom, the mayor said that he doesn't want this dude to retouch the statue, he just wants a new artist to repair it, which I think is probably smart.
That's pretty insulting, which is awesome, but...
anyway.
To me, it's like, you're almost better off having the ugly statue of Lucille Ball, because then it's like, now you're known as the town that has this weird-ass statue of Lucille Ball. I, like, want to go see that statue now, whereas if it was just, like, a regular statue of Lucille Ball, it's pretty boring.
Road trip!
I just think if you're going to have a statue of someone, it needs to look like them. Like, unless it's like totally abstract.
Like the fonts?
Yeah, I was just saying, like, I was just about to say, like, when we went and saw the fonts, like, in the middle of, like, we weren't even looking for it. Mary was on a bench. Was he on a bench? No, he was standing on the bench.
No, he was standing up.
Standing up.
Liz, it's just an 8-hour drive to Celeron, New York. All the way at the tip of New York, basically in Lake Erie.
Wow. That's kind of fun. Anyway. So that was funny to me. Then the other thing that I thought was just awesome was that there's this couple that they're getting married, and the guy's last name is Burger and the woman's last name is King. So it's the Burger King wedding, and Burger King is picking up the tab, and they're paying for the wedding.
What are they going to get? They get
Joel
bunch
Burger
of, bunch of chicken fries? They're going to have chicken fries at the wedding?
No, I think they're just straight up paying for it.
They're going to have rodeo burgers at the wedding?
I don't know, but I was trying to, when I saw this story, I was like, I wonder if I can come up with some, like, great couple names that combine into fast food, but I feel like there aren't really any good, like, other fast food things that are like Burger King. Like, there's McDonald's,
Dairy Queen?
That's like one name. Oh, it could be Dairy Queen. That's one. I actually never
Red Robin?
Dairy Queen. Oh, yeah, Red Robin.
Oh, yeah, I got a friend named Dave Red.
Really?
No, nobody's named
Little,
Red.
Little Caesars? Pizza Hut?
What if you your last name is Rob, is Donald, and you just marry an Irish person and just make it racist?
Why does that make it racist?
Well, you say it's the McDonald wedding.
McDonald.
God.
I thought you were saying, like, McDonald, like, Scottish style. Anyways, I thought that was very funny. That they're the Burger King wedding.
Is burger spelled like hamburger? Or,
yeah,
is,
no,
I mean,
like,
is King spelled with a Y
spelled,
or something?
No, it's spelled burger, like the food. And King.
Why is it so funny to me?
What?
What, K-Y-N-G?
I don't know the idea of burger spelled with a Y. You know what it is? It's because, like, he could have easily said burger with an E, but instead he's like, burger spelled with a Y.
Yeah.
No, King with a Y. King with a Y. K-Y-N-G.
Oh, King what? With a Y. That's your
example.
I'm just trying to burger
I
with a Y.
I don't know if I saw that spelled that way.
Yeah,
Jürger.
Jürger.
Kying. Bürger. Bürger.
B-Y-U-G-E-R. The Y is silent.
I'm going to call Burger King Burger King.
Oh, boy. This one's really out there. This one is really out there. Anybody want to listen to a podcast that doesn't make any sense? You found Careless Whispers. Did I even tweet out that? Nope, I don't think I did. Oh, yeah, I did.
Tweet it out.
I tweeted a picture too. Look at that. All up on the times and stuff. You have anything else for us, Liz, before we send you on your way?
I think that's probably it. That's it. That's the two things.
All right.
That's it. And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't think that they... Oh, good. Thanks.
We could have just sang it for you ourselves again.
But you already did that, so gotta make it special.
Okay. That song really burns out the vocal cords. I didn't know if I could have done it again.
Goodbye, Liz.
Yeah,
thank you.
Of all the dramatic things I've ever seen.
Please.
Goodbye.
I love that Susan Waldman. That Susan Waldman, because she's such a dope. Roger Clemens is a New York Yankee. He will be forever. Long live Susan Waldman. She's still alive, don't worry. Plenty of around. So Liz mentioned lynda.com, and I guess I will too, because they know a lot about stuff. Yeah, stuff, anything. Visual design, photography, software training, web development, work-life balances. What does that mean, you say? Maybe you work too hard. Maybe you need to take a half a day once in a while and just sleep in and then get up and refresh yourself. Now, I just gave away Lynda's secret, but there's a whole lot more over there. Head to lynda.com/CLNS and get a free 10-day trial. That is spelled with a Y, unlike the Burger King wedding. That's lynda.com/CLNS. And all of a sudden, my head seems to be on straight, Calvin, as we power through the first hour here. 3 hours tonight, everybody. No. Only another 25 minutes. That's what it says on the screen.
Probably not even that.
Probably not even that, because we've only got a couple of quick things left.
Unless we get some flowers.
Yeah, I doubt it, but I'll. You know what? I'm going to go to @TeamGreenTruth on Twitter, and I'm going to say, what do you want me to say? Call me and Calvin right now to talk about Aaron Hernandez. And then I'm going to put the number and we'll see if anybody calls. Hashtag Patriots. 347-205-7741. See, this is what podcasts are all about now. You just get the real time, me typing on the computer and tweeting out the link, etc., while Calvin talks about Hernandez. Go.
Is Aaron Hernandez still a Patriot? I just think of him as Aaron Hernandez murderer now.
Well, he is Aaron Hernandez murderer now, but I think there are probably a lot of Patriots fans who are interested in this case, especially since it's something that happened in New England, and he's a former Patriot. I think if I put hashtag Patriots, people might pay attention, or I might just have to delete the tweet later.
Were you a Hernandez guy back when he was in the NFL?
As a player, he was outstanding, right? He was very dynamic, and he put a different element on the field, and as far as the aspects of the game is concerned, he was fast. He ran great routes. He was tough to cover. He caught the ball. As a player, I don't really knock the guy, especially the way that the Patriots were using him. But off the field, all this stuff coming out, it's very apparent that he's a raging psychopath.
Yeah, I thought that, you know, in the wake of Gronk, like he was almost underrated, because yeah, he was a really good football player, but that's not really what we're talking about tonight. What we are talking about tonight is murder trials. And this one, I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, really. Are you a lawyer? Have you gotten a law degree?
No.
I haven't gotten
one. Nope, never even taken any law classes, I don't think. Not even sport law, as far as I remember.
And I haven't been, you know, following this case as closely as a juror, per se. I don't know if Ken, if you have, but, you know,
not as closely as a juror, but I have been following it closer than you, I guess.
Yeah, I've been following it, like, you know, reasonably close. I mean, from this unbiased outside, outside opinion, it seems to me that his defense team not so much putting up much of a fight. What do you think?
Well,
I don't know. Like,
did you hear any of the audio from his lawyer at the end of the trial today, closing arguments and all that?
I read some of it, but I didn't see any of the audio.
So basically, for those that are uninformed and don't know what's going on here, Aaron Hernandez is on trial for the murder of his his fiance's sister's boyfriend. So his soon-to-be brother-in-law, I guess maybe they were close to getting married as well. I'm not sure the details of that, but Odin Lloyd, by all accounts, was his friend as well. And without getting into the whole case, it's on trial now, or the trial has sort of come to a close. Everybody put their closing arguments in. The jury is deliberating. The judge expects a verdict this week. There are a lot of counts of murder and weapons charges and just all these different things that Aaron Hernandez is trying to dodge. And what Calvin is talking about here with the defense sort of coming up lame is today, yesterday, whichever day it was, and actually, maybe even earlier than that, depending on when you're listening, on the CLNS Radio mobile app. Boom. Go get it for Android and Apple devices. iOS. Yeah, baby. And it's free. Anyway, the point is that the defense has basically said, yes, they're acknowledging that he was at the murder scene. He witnessed the murder. And they're trying to now pin it on the two co-defendants who will be tried at a later date, the other people in the situation. And it just seems as though the defense is really just trying to raise reasonable doubt, and they are trying to poke holes in the story and make the jury sort of look at it and say, well, I suppose it's possible that he's not the one that committed this murder, even though he was acting shady after the fact and his girlfriend was dumping things and she clearly threw this box out that had something in it, which we can't disclose because nobody knows exactly. There's no proof that there was a gun or anything like that in the box, and nobody's admitting it. The cooperation was not really there on her part, Shania Jenkins' part, when she testified. So there are a lot of holes in this case, and basically his attorney stood up there after calling three witnesses after the prosecution called like 130, they basically just stood up there and said, well, yeah, Aaron was there, but he's a young kid. He didn't know what to do. He sort of left the scene, and without pointing the finger at one of those guys specifically, whether it's Carlos Ortiz or the other guy, is it Ernest Wallace? I think his name's slipping my mind, but no, that could be him. Either way, without pointing the finger at one of them directly, they basically said Aaron was there, but he didn't do it, so you can't get him on murder charges, but they're essentially throwing him under the bus for all this other crap that has been thrown out there. So he didn't do the murder, but yeah, he has these weapons charges, and he was, I mean, later on, maybe he'll get aiding and abetting or something like that, but they're just basically trying to dodge these murder charges, and I think, unfortunately, they may have raised enough reasonable doubt in this jury that it could the other way, and I just, maybe I play devil's advocate too much, Calvin, but I just have a hard time thinking that this guy's rant, this attorney's rant that he went on at the end in his closing arguments wasn't going to affect at least one of these jurors, so they all see it the common sense way as opposed to the legalese way, but there really is no 100% proof that Hernandez is the one that pulled that trigger.
For usually I tend to side on the side of reasonable doubt in these situations, but Aaron Hernandez is, number one, apparently there's a law in Massachusetts where you don't have to be the trigger person. If you're, like, involved at all in the murder, like, you can be convicted for murder. So, like, the notion that, like, he's not the one who did it, then he was just there. If he's involved in, like, the cover-up and he was involved in, like, getting him to that point, they can already convict him for murder just based on that. Number one. Number two, like, isn't it weird that Aaron Hernandez's, like, legal team didn't bring this, hey, he witnessed the killing defense up until basically closing arguments of the trial? And trial, like, you said, they called three witnesses. Like, the whole point up until then with the three witnesses was to sort of try to discredit the fact that Aaron Hernandez's DNA was on the shell casing in the car.
They were trying to discredit the prosecution's witnesses as well with their witnesses. That's basically what their argument was. And this whole time, they seem like they've just been running a case where they're just trying to poke holes in the other team's argument as opposed to providing a actual reason why Aaron Hernandez should be let off of this.
Right. Excuse me. I'm somewhat okay with that because the burden of proof should be on the prosecution, although, like, in practical terms, juries don't see it that way. I just think that, like, their theory all of a sudden that he was there, like, it seemed like in up until that point, they seemed to be arguing, like you said, trying to poke holes in the prosecution's case in the way that suggested, like, hey, Aaron Hernandez, you know, didn't do this, wasn't involved. And all of a sudden at the end of the trial, and they didn't call Aaron Hernandez to the stand. So, like, it's almost like they're speculating, hey, Aaron Hernandez did see this. Although we're not going to tell you, like, what he saw or, you know, what he saw or, like, what happened specifically, why this happened, even though Aaron Hernandez apparently knows. We admit that he knows what's going on, but, hey, it wasn't him. Like, good luck proving it was him. You know what I mean? But you're not – apparently –
That's essentially what their case is, yeah.
Yeah. If you're saying he was there and he witnessed it, then that means that, like, he can shed light on the situation, or some of the witness can shed light on the situation. But you're not even going to make that point because your argument is so weak that you're leaving them with nothing except to be like, well, I hope you guys are Patriots fans. That's their argument seems to me. Like, I don't know. His lawyers, I'm sure, are highly paid lawyers who I thought would have made, you know, some crazy defense. But this is, like, this, you know, guilt or innocence aside, it seems to me to be, like, one of the weaker defenses I can remember in a high-profile case like this.
Yeah, it just seems like I really don't know where they're coming from with this. Although, hearing what he said, I did understand where he was coming from. Like, he was basically trying to get rid of the biggest charge that's out there. And I mean, I guess that's one way to go about it. If you start to realize that he's going to be guilty of something, you start to try and take away the bigger charges. And I think you can sort of look at that to sort of cross-reference trials that are going on right now. The Boston Marathon bombing, Jokhar Tsarnaev trial is happening right now. And his defense team has sort of tried to come out and pin the whole thing on his older brother. And that is not to say that Jokhar Tsarnaev wasn't involved, because it seems to be very clear on video and all that he was involved. But they're trying to get the death penalty sort of out of the options that can be served to this kid, because if he wasn't the mastermind behind the whole thing, death penalty is not supposed to be a question. It's just a matter of how much of the lesser charges he'll get convicted of. Now, so I mean, I guess this is sort of a standard defense practice. When you know your client's guilty of something, you try and sort of divert attention from the bigger thing, right? And say, yeah, they did all these other things, so get him on this, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he did the big thing you're looking at. He didn't do the murder. He wasn't the mastermind of the bombing, et cetera, you know?
Yeah, I guess, but I might feel like if that was their strategy, why wouldn't they...
They should have done it earlier, yeah.
It seems like they just decided that's what they were going to do. You know what I mean? Like, at the last minute, they're like, okay, well, this is not going to work out. Why don't we just do this?
Yeah, they thought that they were going to be able to do a better job maybe of defending him, and they just didn't, and they realized what it was going to come down to here in the last couple of days. So anyway, that's that for that. One more topic. Do you want to hit on this baseball thing after I tell the people to go and check out Jared Weiss's great work on the Garden Report? The HD post-game show? After the post-game show. That's right. The post-game show after the post-game show. Because once you listen to the Celtics post-game show here on CLNS Radio, Jared calls in, he gives you his little locker room report, and then he goes and does the big thing. He does the Garden Report, where he shoots on the parquet, sometimes up in the rafters, sometimes he's down in a hall if there's something going on in the garden and they got to set up for a Bruins game, etc., something like that. But he's there after every game. He's got great guests, great interviews. Check it out, The Garden Report, youtube.com/CLNSradio. And our final thing, Calvin, is baseball everywhere. It was opening day yesterday, or Sunday officially, but the rest of the league got together on Monday and played their first games. The Red Sox are off tonight. This is Tuesday. If you're listening in the morning, the Red Sox play tonight. Uh-huh. See what I did there? But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a West Coast team that is really being kind of despicable, Calvin. I'm sure that you know more about this than I do. Why don't you go ahead with it?
Hey, should we do baseball picks next week?
I guess. I mean, it's a little, I mean, it might be a little late for that. It's only one. Oh, you know what? I'm going to the Celtics game next week, so we don't have a show.
Oh, look at that. Look at that.
Womp.
Well, Dodgers are going to be good. There's my baseball preview. So Josh Hamilton. Looks like appears that he did some cocaine, and he reported it to Major League Baseball officials after the
fact. Self-report, yep.
Self-report, yeah. And the people, I don't know what the name, the committee who decides whether or not it's a violation of his agreement with Major League Baseball, deadlocked on it, 2-2. And they brought in an arbitrator to decide, you know, whether or not it was a violation of their agreement with Josh Hamilton. And the arbitrator decided, no, it was not. And the Angels then came out, not, you'd think they'd come out in support of their player, but instead they did the opposite. They said, the Angels GM came out and said, it's not logical that this is not a violation. I don't understand it. And I'm not very happy about that for a couple of reasons. One, really, it seems that the whole process was supposed to be done confidentially, and like, nobody was supposed to know about it. But instead, there's like anonymous reports going to the LA Times that people suspect were the Angels, because obviously Josh Hamilton like wouldn't report himself as a draggy to the newspaper, right? And Major League Baseball has nothing to gain from it, because if Josh Hamilton's not found guilty of violating his agreement, then it just makes him look bad and makes baseball look bad for not punishing him. So the only party in this situation who has motivation for making it public are the Angels, trying to manipulate the process and put pressure on baseball to try to make it to where this guy's in violation of his contract, so his contract can be voided, because Josh Hamilton has been terrible. And like, the best case scenario for the Angels is if his contract was voided and they didn't have to pay it. He's owed like another $70 million. So the team was hoping that, you know, that it would be voided. They wouldn't have to pay it. And then, you know, it'd be best case scenario for everyone. But again, the problem is, one, it's supposed to be confidential. So everybody thinks it was the Angels, but there's no proof of it. So I guess, you know, all I can say is, okay, well, what are you going to do? But I'm not happy about it. I think that the Angels organization, like, once they found out that he wasn't going to be suspended, should have, like, supported their player in some way, you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't a violation. He did self-report. And most importantly, like, he's an addict who, like, he slipped. He tried cocaine once, and then he reported himself in a situation where he wasn't going to test positive, so he did the right thing, and everyone's right. Coming down on this guy like he's a monster and like he should be suspended for the year.
You know what? So what happens if it happens again? Sure, it happened one time. He self-reported. What if he does this again in 2 months and he self-reports? Do they then should they do something about it and come down on him a little bit?
Well, the thing about cocaine is like it doesn't stay in your system that long. See what I'm saying? So if they had a test scheduled, excuse me, if they had a test scheduled, then they're going to test him anyway at that point, and he's going to be found in violation of his agreement. But he reported in at a time that like wasn't going to pass him his test. So in a way, he's doing the right thing, and he's trying to find help. So I think that as an addict, if he slips and he's not in violation of the agreement, then I don't think that you should punish him. No. Why? Like, he's an addict. I think if he slips again, you should put him in a program. You know what I mean? You should talk to him. But I don't think that you should void his contract. I don't think you should void his contract anyway. But he did have an agreement. So, technically, if he's in violation of the agreement, like, they're within their rights to do whatever they want. But if he's not, then he's not. And the Angels shouldn't, like, they shouldn't be just looking for any opportunity they can to dump this guy. When, one, he's a dude who needs help, he's trying, clearly. Like, it's not like he went on a binge and, you know what I mean? Like, okay, he's relapsed and now he's a mess. And now he's constantly a problem for us. And clearly he's not going to be able to play baseball. It was like a thing where he slipped one time and then he felt bad about it and he reported himself. Those are two different situations. If he slips back into being what he was, then sure. But that's not what we're talking about here, then.
All right, but I guess I kind of agree with you, but I love to play that, as my friends will sometimes tell you. That frustrates the hell out of them sometimes as well. But
I like it.
Somebody would argue that if he does it again in 2 months, then maybe he is slipping back. And then he does. And maybe, what's to stop him from doing it again? Maybe he's doing it at times when he doesn't have to report. And now that he's set up this fact that he's self-reported, this is the conspiracy theory in me talking. Now that he's set this up, he can just get away with it at times when he knows he's not going to be tested.
Well, what's to stop Yasiel Puig from doing coke in times when he's not going to be tested? What's to stop Aaron Hernandez, who admitted in court that he smokes a ton of weed, from smoking weed during times when he's not being tested? You know what I mean? There's nothing to stop anybody from doing anything. But if there are agreements, there are guidelines set in place by the union for this specific thing. Like, Do you feel like we have to be the police for this guy, for Josh Hamilton? Like, what if he does do coke? Do you think that, like, obviously you're gonna be able to tell if he like physically deteriorates, but if he let's say he takes a bump now and then and he doesn't get caught for it,
right? Does that you know, tickle your moral fancy to the degree where you feel insulted by this? Like, it's an outrage and we got to do something about it?
No, certainly not. No, I don't. But if Major League Baseball is trying to keep this squeaky clean image, that, I mean, they don't have it, but they're trying to get to that, and that's what the baseball purists still think of the game, that they're squeaky clean, then they probably will want to do something about it if it happens again, right? I don't know. That's just the way that I would look at it if I was trying to come down on the guy, which I am not personally.
Well, if they were mostly concerned about their squeaky clean image, wouldn't it be better had they kept a tighter ship on the fact that it leaked out in the first place? Shouldn't we just not know about this at all and go into training camp, you know, hoping everything's okay with Josh Hamilton? Like, why do we even know about it then if that's the case? You're creating drama for a situation where, yeah.
Well, we know about it because the Angels probably wanted it to be out there, and I know that we just talked about that. But I would say that they are the most likely candidate to have put this out there because they wanted to get his contract voided or something, you know.
So if Kelly Olynyk went to Brad Stevens and said, "Yeah, I have a coke problem," like I, excuse me. I'm not going to get caught. I always know when to do it, and the league's drug testing is a joke. But I have this issue, and I can't stop. Not even that I can't stop. I have this issue. I'm going to stop, but I just want you to know. And then Brad Stevens went and like said that in a press conference. Like, how would you feel about Stevens and the Celtics in that situation? Would you admire the transparency, or would you be like, how is this cool? Because I lean towards the latter in that situation.
Yeah, I wouldn't want them to just be cool with that. I think that they would they should come out and say that they're going to help the player, etc. But I mean, why would they just come out and say something in the first place unless they didn't like the player, which in this case it looks like they don't like the player. Kelly Olynyk, I think the Celtics like. If Gerald Wallace had that situation and they wanted to get out of his contract, just to use an example that could be relatively comparable to Josh Hamilton and his gaudy contract, then I think that maybe there's grounds to bring it up as the organization. But to throw a player under the bus that you like, I think that they would probably try and get that player help before they did something like that. But the point is that they should just try and get the player help regardless of the contract and regardless of who they are and whether they think that they fit in on the team. They signed the contract with your organization. They should try and help them. So that's where the Angels are being shady and really – kind of despicable, especially if they're the ones that put this leak out there, and just with the owner coming out or GM, whoever it was, coming out and saying that it should be a violation. It's a little shady. That's all. Anyway, Calvin, that's it for us.
Protect
We're
your
done.
Players. Protect your players.
Exactly.
Organization. Don't try to look for outs. The same thing. You know, I don't like A-Rod, but like, look, they signed that contract with Josh Hamilton. Forget A-Rod, we don't have time. But
no.
They signed that contract with him knowing who he was, knowing that he's trying to recover, and slipping up one time in doing a bump, like, that shouldn't be, you know, you shouldn't look at it as your opportunity to then try to get out of the contract just because you signed a bad deal. Live with your deal.
Yeah, I agree. It's slimy. And that's how we're going to end tonight, with the word slimy. Good night, everyone.
This is the story of a girl who cried a river and drowned the whole world. And why she looks so sad in photographs. I absolutely love her. This is the story of a girl. Pretty girl.